gathered up members of the media entity in Tehran to discuss new trends in news production and explore areas of cooperation between its members.
So basically, OANA has now become somewhat of a center of the world-balanced approach to journalism. Nowadays, it's quite difficult to find media companies outside of Asia and Africa who are looking for a balanced approach to news. Basically, a lot of the major media companies of the world have decided to play only for one side.
I'm from Lebanon's state news agency. I believe this summit provides a platform for media diplomacy between the member news agencies to reach common grounds on world affairs.
OANA currently has 43 members from 35 countries, covering two-thirds of the world population. As a member, the Islamic Republic News Agency, or shortly IRNA, is hosting this year's General Assembly, based on a voting that took place during the 17th OANA Summit in Seoul, South Korea.
Today is a good opportunity for the representatives of prominent news agencies present in Tehran for the OANA meeting to observe the conditions in Iran. An independent media current is needed to disseminate the realities.
Formed in 1961 on UNESCO's initiative, the Organization of Asia-Pacific News Agencies is an association of news agencies from UNESCO member states in the Asia-Pacific region. OANA provides a newswire service containing articles provided by its members. Aside from IRNA, Iran's Fars News and Mehr News agencies are also among OANA members.
Delegates here say OANA's main goal is to break the Western monopoly on media and to present an alternative narrative on regional and global developments, as opposed to, quote, the narrative offered by mainstream media. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Russian flag now flies over Donetsk, as Russia claims this region is now part of the Russian Federation. The streets in the center are quiet as Ukraine continues to bomb the city. The front line is only 6 kilometers away. In order to find out how people here feel about their new identity, I headed down the road to the adjoining city of Makiivka. There are more people on the streets as it's safer here.
We are very happy. We've been waiting for it for a long time. We're very glad. All acquaintances, neighbors, all people surrounding me are grateful to Russia.
It's a complicated question. After everything that's been going on, it can be no other way now. There is no other way but to be with Russia. We were close people always. We couldn't be divided. We lived quite okay in Ukraine, but it's no longer Ukraine. Their authorities are not Ukrainian anymore.
This is a common sentiment in Donbass, that they were happy being part of Ukraine, but when the nationalists came to power in 2014 and began discriminating against Russian culture and bombing civilians here, they turned toward Russia.
We have been waiting for it. Donbass was eager to become part of Russia. We have the same values, culture, and now that we are part of Russia, we can be ourselves.
I'll tell the truth. While they've been shelling us and we were living in fear, in Kiev, they were enjoying themselves. Nobody in Kiev paid any attention. There are people there who support and understand us, but they cannot speak about it. They can be killed or imprisoned by the SBU for this. We're not against Ukrainian civilians. We are Ukrainian people too. I have relatives there. We have pity for people in Kiev, but nobody's killing them there on purpose.
Thousands have been killed by Ukrainian shelling over the last 8 years here. Hardly a day goes by without more civilians dying. Most of the anger I hear, though, is directed at the Ukrainian government, not its people.
I sympathize with them very much. I am always against people being killed, but it's war. Nothing can be done about it. They're killing us and we have to defend ourselves. Sometimes we had to hide in basements because of shelling. I work at school. Our school was under shelling. The windows were smashed. It's very scary.
Now, doing vox pops in cities on issues around the world, you usually get a variety of opinions. Not so here. Everybody I've spoken to says they want to join Russia. The only difference of opinion seems to be just how much sympathy they have for people in Kiev now living under shelling themselves. The people here have been doing so for the last 8 years. While the southern regions of Zaporozhye and Kherson are more mixed, for peace to come, it's clear the world needs to accept that the vast majority of people in Donbass no longer want to be part of Ukraine. Jenny Miller, Donbass.
It's taken him a few weeks longer than anticipated, but former Chancellor Rishi Sunak is now the leader of the Conservative Party and Prime Minister-elect of the UK, and of course, the first ethnic minority to hold either position. In a rather stage-managed affair, Sunak made his first public address to the nation.
But there is no doubt we face a profound economic challenge. We now need stability and unity, and I will make it my utmost priority to bring our party and our country together.
Sunak had been the favoured candidate with fellow MPs in the leadership contest held in the summer, but had to settle for runner-up spot. This after Liz Truss won the vote of the Tory party members. This time, MPs saw to it that this was an internal matter, with voters looking on as yet another Conservative MP was anointed.
We had Johnston, we had Liz Truss very briefly, and now we have Sunak. Ordinary people in Britain have got no say over who becomes Prime Minister. That is a democratic deficit, and I think it sticks in the throats of many, many people in this country.
Sunak was keen to emphasise unity and stability, but those might be wishful ideas for a party that's literally at war with itself.
But there's been so much infighting within inside the Conservative Party, it's very difficult to see how they can all just lay down their knives and be friends again. Now, obviously, the sight of Labour running well ahead in the opinion polls will unite them. They're not lemmings, they don't want to commit suicide. That's why there won't be an election soon.
Prime Minister. Sunak's leadership will be tested by the presence of figures like former Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who claimed to have had the support to run for high office, but conceded now was not the right time for his return. How can Sunak ensure he doesn't follow the Liz Truss path to political collapse?
For many, the British premiership is a poison chalice. With the country facing one of the worst cost of living crises in a generation, with, of course, more austerity measures bound to be implemented and a political landscape more divided than ever, the new occupants of Downing Street face a Herculean task to try and pull Britain back from the brink.
Amina Taylor, London.
EU leaders at a summit in Brussels agreed China is becoming too assertive. It's the same phrase they have been using for years with respect to Russia. Iran was also in their sights. New restrictive measures against Tehran were rubber stamped.
Sanctions have been taken against those who are participating in the repression of peaceful demonstrations. And this, of course, is linked to the support of Russia against Ukraine.
Analysts say the allegations against Iran are spurious and they are being vehemently contested. It's pointed out that the bloc sometimes ignores clear international law violations, even when there's zero ambiguity. For example, those perpetrated by Israel against Palestinians. The US is set to have even greater influence over the EU as the bloc moves to try and isolate Moscow and Beijing. It's suggested that has been Washington's plan all along.
Europe, they are totally dependent on the United States and in energy field and in military field. And that is dependency that doesn't allow them to conduct independent foreign policies.
Sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine have driven energy costs to unmanageable levels. A complex package has been agreed in principle by EU leaders to try and lower prices and demand.
There's a lot of work now ahead of us what the energy is concerned, but the roadmap is very clear. And it was good to have this unanimity, this broad support for the roadmap that we have put forward.
Leaders admit the energy package is very complex and will take up to 3 weeks to try and finalise. Will this summit deliver positive results for EU citizens? It's a crucial question for millions of households and businesses, but also a vital political question for the bloc's leaders. Extreme left and extreme right anti-EU parties are waiting in the wings. Ignoring massive corruption findings by their own financial watchdog, EU leaders have agreed to provide €18 billion to the Ukrainian government in 2023. But that's nothing compared to what they will spend on lethal weapons for the country's army. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
It's no land at the heart of a scorching but amazing island. Snowtown is one of the latest entertainment centers in Iran's Kish Island in the Persian Gulf. Every year, some 2 million visitors from inside and outside Iran visit the island to enjoy its attractions, from its entertainment centers to its stunning beach.
The beach and the pier in Kish are really peaceful and tranquilizing. It's the third time I'm visiting the island, and I went parasailing, water skiing, and I'm planning to go scuba diving.
Kish Island offers all kinds of sea entertainment activities, from scuba diving to sailing, and oh yes, flyboarding. Besides sea sports, visitors can enjoy its amusement parks and a range of leisure activities inside the island. And if you're a tireless window shopper, Kish is a land of malls and shopping centers.
Kish is an amazing island. It used to be an abandoned island some 3 decades ago, but today it is a luxurious tourist resort with modern buildings and exciting recreational places.
Despite all the pleasure one can have in Kish, the island still has many shortcomings. The major issue annoying visitors is the poor accommodation services.
Hotel facilities and services are a bit weak given the large number of tourists that visit this island. They need to pay more attention to the accommodation infrastructure.
Just a few hundred kilometers away from Kish, there's a tourist magnet in the United Arab Emirates, Dubai, which absorbs the chunk of foreign tourists. While U.S. sanctions on Iran are a major factor to blame for Kish lagging behind in its rivalry with Dubai, the island's officials believe it still has a chance to win the game of tourism against Dubai.
If we want to excel, it is not going to be a tough job. We need to work on two major areas. The first is the infrastructure, and the second is regulations that would allow tourists or investors to easily come to Kish to entertain themselves or do business.
Situated off the southern coast of Iran in the Persian Gulf, Kish is one of Iran's free trade zones. Foreign travelers do not need a visa to visit the island, as travel permits are issued on arrival by Kish officials and are valid for up to 14 days.
With its mesmerizing nature and eye-catching urban landscapes, Kish has earned the title of the Bride of the Persian Gulf. Its authorities say the island is already a hub for Iranian travelers, but they say they seek to turn it into a regional tourist magnet. Yusuf Jalali from Kish Island.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The pillars of U.S. supremacy are shaking as emerging economies are developing in a rapid pace. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media to know their idea about this issue. Stay tuned. The website of Middle East Eye wrote, "The world order is fading away, and there is still no clear idea about the next one. It took just 30 years. The Cold War ended, but a warm peace lasted barely a decade. The pillars of the U.S.-led rules-based world order, neoliberalism, free market economy, unregulated finance, and globalization are now all in question. At the dawn of the 21st century, history and nature began to assertively reclaim their prerogatives from an overconfident and hubristic humanity. The events of 9/11 and the long American wars in Iraq and Afghanistan tarnished the unipolar leadership of the U.S. regime and its military superiority. Pax Americana has been in retreat ever since. The 2008 global financial crisis raised doubts about a greedy, speculative, over-financialized, and under-regulated economy. The fallout has been harsh austerity measures, spreading massive inequality. The latest data from the U.S. and U.K. are chilling. Long-lasting monetarist economic theories have been cast aside, while printing money has become the new normal in the U.S. and EU. Blind trust in the market's balancing role, the so-called invisible hand, has been shaken. Financial bailouts and the COVID-19 pandemic have shown that a visible hand, that of the state, is necessary. Neoliberal politicians, economists, and pundits have suddenly forgotten what they have been preaching for decades. China has slowly awoken and reclaimed the role it had for the overwhelming part of the last two millennia as the world's leading economic power. And it has gone even further, becoming an impressive technological power, with examples including 5G, artificial intelligence, and quantum computing, and an expanding military power. This has sent alarm bells ringing in Washington. The U.S. was shocked by China's rise and remains unwilling to share its long-established global hegemony. Reading the tea leaves correctly is thus crucial. But the Western media has already gotten it wrong in coverage of the recent Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit, obsessively searching for a split between China and Russia, when the real news was the long queue of countries willing to join the organization. Iran and Belarus have been admitted, and others could soon be added, including Egypt, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Bahrain, Kuwait, and the UAE. Incidentally, they are all allies and partners of the U.S. While it is true that Moscow and Beijing hold different views on many issues, the die is cast. They are on the same boat, with even the economists recognizing this fact. A key event is set to take place in China next month, when Xi Jinping is expected to be reappointed as the country's top leader for an unprecedented third mandate that could pave the way for his nomination for life. And in November, the U.S. midterm elections will determine whether the Biden administration can carry on its ambitious agenda, both inside and outside the country. A week later, the G20 summit in Indonesia will show how relations are evolving among the Global South and Global North blocs. What is clear now is that
globalization is crumbling. As Zoltan Pozsar of Credit Suisse masterfully summarized, globalization was fueled by cheap gas from Russia to Europe and cheap products from China to the U.S., which sustained the American consumerist dream. The system also relied on American financial dominance, built upon the U.S. dollar as the global reserve currency. And for decades, it was gifted with low inflation and zero interest rates. This situation is no more. U.S. financial hegemony is less tolerated, as the dollar has been excessively weaponized against anyone who does not align with Washington's positions. The main keywords now are decoupling and reshoring in the face of increasingly disrupted global supply chains. Cut off from Russia's cheap energy, Europe is adopting far more expensive alternatives. The US and China are increasingly decoupling from each other without even asking what impacts could follow from the cut off of supply chains and financial flows. The website of Global Times said, "The world today is undergoing accelerating changes unseen in a century and has entered a new phase of uncertainty and transformation. Human society has reached a crossroads and faces unprecedented challenges. Under these new conditions, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, as an important constructive force in international and regional affairs, should keep itself well-positioned in the face of changing international dynamics and better assume its historical mission. Countries should enhance mutual support and work together to cope with complex changes in external environment. In today's world, conflicts are looming large between unity and division, cooperation and confrontation. The SCO is under great test in maintaining regional peace and security, and its member states face severe challenges in maintaining their own security and stability. Only by strengthening high-level exchanges and strategic communication, deepening mutual understanding and political trust, guarding against attempts by external forces to instigate color revolution, and jointly opposing interference in other countries' internal affairs under any pretext, can countries safeguard their security and development interests and hold their future firmly in their own hands." Countries should expand security cooperation and jointly uphold long-term peace and stability in the region. Over the years, with an eye on common security, the SCO member states have carried out practical and efficient security cooperation, which has ensured the overall security and stability in the region. Amid a complex and volatile regional security landscapes, it is all the more important to stay true to the vision of common, comprehensive, cooperative, and sustainable security and build a balanced, effective, and sustainable security architecture, constantly upgrade the level of law enforcement and security cooperation within the SCO, and strictly prevent terrorist and extremist forces from destabilizing regional security. Countries need to deepen practical cooperation to materialize a shared vision of development and rejuvenation. Common development is real development, and sustainable development is a good development. All SCO countries are at a crucial stage of development. They should leverage their unique strength of geographical proximity and intertwined interest. They should uphold the vision of innovative, coordinated, green, open, and shared growth to achieve integrated regional economic development, energize growth, vitality, and deliver a better life to their people. Countries should enhance people-to-people and cultural exchanges to consolidate public support for the long-term development of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Consolidate public support for the long-term development of the SCO. The most solid foundation for SCO's development lies in mutual learning among civilizations, and the most profound strength lies in people-to-people ties. They need to promote exchanges, dialogue, and harmonious coexistence among different civilizations, deepen cooperation in such areas as education, science and technology, culture, health, media, radio, and television, and build bridges of mutual understanding and amity between the people. Countries should uphold multilateralism and work together to make the international order more just and equitable. As a Chinese saying goes, power may win for the time being, but justice will prevail for the long run. Faced with power politics, bullying, and hegemonic practices, the SCO should assume its due international responsibility by safeguarding the UN-centered international system and the international order based on international law, promoting the common values of humanity, expanding SCO's exchanges with other international and regional organizations such as the UN, and improving global governance so as to make greater contributions to world peace and development. Over the years, with its own development, China has propelled the development of countries in the region, brought more benefits to people around the world, and continuously injected vigorous impetus into the SCO development. China proposed initiatives such as the Belt and Road Initiative, BRI, and a community with a shared future for mankind have been included in the outcome documents of the SCO mechanism. Its proposals, such as the Global Development Initiative and the Global Security Initiative, have also been highly praised by leaders of various parties within the SCO. At the summit, China called for continued efforts to achieve the complementarity of the BRI with national development strategies and regional cooperation initiatives. This call has received active response from relevant parties who agreed that the BRI is an important engine for building a community with a shared future for mankind. Building on past achievements, countries should continue to act in the Shanghai spirit, work for the steady development of the SCO, and jointly build the region into a peaceful, stable, prosperous, and beautiful home.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The UK has another new Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak. He has said that he was not daunted by the scale of the economic challenge, pledging to lead the country through an economic crisis and to rebuild trust in politics. Well, that makes one wonder whether Sunak is really aware of the scale of the economic crisis that the UK is in, from inflation to the cost of living crisis to the political infighting and radical changes in policy that have horrified investors, alarming international allies. Sunak has his hands full. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether Sunak has the solutions needed to bring the UK out of this economic and political mess.
During his first speech as British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak used the occasion to issue a call for unity. Sunak must find a way to quickly unite not just a bitterly divided Conservative Party, but also a deeply troubled nation. However, he also issued warnings of difficult times ahead.
I will place economic stability and confidence at the heart of this government's agenda. This will mean difficult decisions to come.
The Prime Minister has inherited a country in crisis. Energy prices are high, cost of living through the roof, and millions of Brits are expected to struggle this winter. Another worry for Sunak, Conservative Party popularity has plummeted in recent months, sitting approximately 30 points behind the opposition Labour Party. Sunak's supporters say he's economically experienced from his days as Chancellor and praised Sunak as Britain's youngest leader in 200 years and the first ever non-white leader. But his critics claim that's just not enough.
He definitely has the credentials. He definitely has the experience, been there in the as Chancellor before. But again, we need to understand, you know, where does he sit right here, right now, with everyday voters? He has not been elected by the people, as well as he. Most people feel that he cannot resonate with the ones that are struggling. I'm not sure if it is real representation for anyone of a minority background, especially when he comes from a very, very elitist club, and he does not really represent many. He's probably top 1% of majority of brown people or Asians, whatever you want to call it, in the entire world. So it's very difficult to sort of resonate and feel sort of close in that way.
Many challenges lie ahead for the new Prime Minister, in particular how he's going to overcome Britain's many economic crises. However, even if he does find a way to overcome Britain's economic woes, question marks still remain surrounding if he has what it takes to win the Conservatives the next general election. Robert Carter, London.
We're going to go with our guests. Let me introduce them for this program. Limpet Opec, former member of the British Parliament, joins us from London. Also joining us is Shebri Rizvi, political analyst, who also joins us from London.
Is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. I'll start with you, Limpet Opec, taking a look at the soap opera there in the UK with Rishi Sunak, a 42-year-old former hedge fund boss. I picked these out, see what you think. Only been in politics for 7 years, and estimated fortune, £730 million, or $830 million. And that is pointing to what many are feeling, that he may not be able to connect with Brits who are feeling inflation or who are in poverty. Obviously, a public that's strained by things that have put them into the crisis that they're in right now. Is that accurate?
We shall find out. But you've accurately raised his potential Achilles heel. Let's be honest. For a man who is worth over £700 million, a small increase to him of a couple of £1,000 in energy bills isn't going to be very important. He could almost be regarded as a hobby politician because he isn't going to suffer if the economy does. And so that's the biggest single question. Can he understand what millions of people in the UK are now suffering in terms of finances? The second one is, can he fix it? Liz Truss, in her 44 days in office, managed to trash the British economy. It was already in trouble. partly because of some idiotic energy policies, but she wrecked it. My estimate is that she has cost mortgage payers in the United Kingdom £80,000 million a year in extra interest rates. I'm one of those people. So can Rishi Sunak really wind back to the clock to a time where we have much more favourable interest rates, and for a lot of people, paying an extra £8,000 or £10,000 a year is going to make them essentially poor. And then the third and the last point, is he clubbable? By that I mean, can he do what Boris Johnson did very well, which was appeal to individuals who wouldn't normally vote Conservative, but they did this time, and they gave Boris Johnson a big majority. Now, those are three big challenges. Of course, I'm not saying Labour Party could do any better, but they could win by default. If you get, if he doesn't do three out of three of the things I listed there, then two out of three isn't good enough, and that means he could lose the general election. That's what he's going to be judged on by his own party.
Taking a look at his economic agenda there, Shabir Rizvi, what is it? Do you know? Do we know? I mean, at this point, it may be too early to tell.
Hello, good evening. I don't think it's too late, because obviously the Sunak scenario is exactly the same as what the Conservative Party has been practicing for the last 12 years. We are told that it's going to be a difficult time. We have to take bold decisions. At the same time, he needs to fix the economy. What are these bold decisions? Does that mean that further cutting of the healthcare, further cutting of the schools sort of funding, further cutting on other social services in the United Kingdom? So if that's what he means by bold decisions, what I would say the bold decisions would be is to, cap the bonuses of the bankers in London. It would be to increase perhaps the taxation to the highest earners, the 1%, his own cabal, who is in the category of millionaires, should they be paying more? Perhaps a bold decision would be to have a windfall tax on the energy providers. A bold decision on the economy would be to, bring parity for the lower paid earners, i.e., for example, just take one instance, a nurse. At the beginning, 12 years ago, when the Conservative Party came into power, is £4,000 less well off than she was 12 years ago. So bold decision would be to bring equal parity to the key workers, nurses, the policemen, the teachers, the care workers. I can go on. Multiple other sort of employees who have really lost out, not just on pay increases not taking place, but due to the inflation, they're actually a lot poorer than they were even 12 years ago. So bold decisions. So as I said, the Sunak scenario doesn't sound any different than what has been practiced for the last 12 years. Yes, of course, the previous prime minister we've had, as you know, three prime ministers in 3 months, hers was really an experiment to see whether ideological, fundamentalist, right-wing economic policies should be applied to the United Kingdom. And we saw what happened. Perhaps Mr. Sunak being more clever than Truss would actually do it more gently, but the end result would be more austerity, poor becoming poorer, and really the belt tightening would be required of the 99%, whilst the 1% really go to the bank all the way laughing.
When you have 17% of an increase in things like food, for example, Lempit OPEC, and of course we can talk about the inflation into other sectors, in particular at the top of the list practically would be the energy sector and gas bills. He's got to do something about those two. But the fact that our guest, Shabir Rizvi, talks about income, how it's fallen behind, obviously was behind. Inflation obviously put that in fifth gear in terms of it falling behind even more. There's got to be an impact soon. But that could only be done if you're generating income. Not to get too technical about this, but generating income would then come in through the form of projections in one sense. But in this atmosphere of a war and lack of energy and what we're looking at, which is a recession, which many say the UK is not in one, but it is in a recession. How can he bring in results quickly, which is the key here?
We are in a recession in any meaningful way. The average citizen, not the millionaires, but the average citizen is feeling a lot poorer. And you've mentioned the three big things here: mortgages, fuel costs, and food costs. Those three are crippling anyone who was just about managing a few months ago. And turning to your question and continuing the debate, it's very hard to see what Rishi Sunak can do quickly without either borrowing even more, and he has borrowed more than any chancellor in the history of Britain, certainly since World War II, or making the kind of cuts that my colleague has just listed. Both of those are very difficult. It's probably easier for him to borrow, but then, of course, the world has just marked down the credibility of British politics and British government because it borrowed so much. At least it was going to under Liz Truss. So what is he to do? He can hope for a miracle. It's not going to come. He can ditch the energy policies, which are based heavily on environmental policies now. Wherever you stand on whether there's a climate crisis or not, Britain can't afford to do this right now. He should ditch net zero, and he should use fracking and domestic oil production to quickly reduce fuel prices. In terms of food prices, they'll then come down a little bit, just because energy is so important. Fuel is such a high percentage of most of the costs in the United Kingdom. But the big one is actually the mortgage situation. If you have a £200,000 mortgage, you're paying £8,000 a year extra every year. That dwarfs the increase in energy costs. What can he do about that? The only thing he can do is get interest rates down. Two ways to do that. One is to convince the Bank of England it can do that. And that's difficult when you've got 10% inflation. Or he could renationalize the Bank of England. That's the radical thing he could do. He could own interest rates, as occurred for decades, for pretty much a century in the UK, before a gesture of virtue signaling, the Labour Party said, no, you go off and set the interest rates independently. But as you can see from that list, it's a really difficult thing for Rishi Sunak to deliver. And probably it's going to get worse rather than get better. He's going to have a winter of discontent.
We need to understand, Shabir Rissi, if you can, with the short amount of time that we have, as to what and why, I should say, the UK is in the position that it is in terms of its economy, which is cited to be one of the worst of the G7 countries, not just because of the pandemic, but prior to that. And maybe even some saying as far back as the 2007-08 financial crisis when it hit, maybe the UK was not able to truly recover, and it was just dragging itself along with GDP increases that were not that noteworthy. Are we looking at that far back when it comes to the UK economy dragging its feet and not doing well? And then, of course, then you got COVID, and then you got the Ukraine conflict, and here we are.
Well, indeed, one has to look back over the last 12 years, and I have quite often pointed this out in our conversations on this matter, is that the financial crisis that hit the world in 2008, and of course it hit USA, the European Union, then we had what is called quantitative easing, literally government buying their own security, printing of money, all kinds of things. But then we had a Conservative Party came into power soon after in 2010. And they practiced really an ideologically based economic policy of austerity. This is what the IMF sort of prescribes to developing world wherever there's economic issues. They say that, you know, have austerity, sort of increase this, do less social welfare issues that impact the majority of the public. That kind of formula was applied not at the behest of the IMF, but really the government, which was ideologically based and wanting to really continue the practice of very sort of monetarist approach to the British economy. And here we have 12 years later, yes, you know, the mantra in the UK is even when the former Prime Minister Truss was leaving, she said Putin, But really, look, you know, the war in Ukraine may have some impact here. And the reality is that we are sort of burning money by supplying armaments to the Ukrainians. That will, of course, have an impact on the UK. Yes, we have sort of sanctioned Russia. Therefore, the oil and gas are not coming on the market, hence increasing the energy price. But the reality is that the Conservative Party needs to abandon its ideologically based economic policies. They really don't have much left in the fiscal armory to do. Yes, we've got the Chancellor who's going to be announcing his budget on 31st of October, an ominous day, Halloween, you know, which is the sign of sort of coming out of summer into the dark days of winter. Perhaps Britain is moving into the dark days of winter, whilst we haven't had a very bright summer either.
Well, to use your words, dark days of winter is what I think we're looking at, Lampadopic, if you agree, where there has been predictions made by, I think, the UK electric power grid that there may be three-hour outages in electricity. So let's take a little bit of a break, Lampadopic, if we can, from the economic aspects of Rishi Sunak and the challenges he faces there, and how he needs to get his party together. Based on the report that we just saw by Rob Carter, the Conservative Party's popularity is really lagging behind the Labour, and it has dropped quite dramatically. And there's, of course, talks of infighting within the party. How much of a challenge does that pose for Sunak, even though he is picking, I guess, new cabinet members, and a reshuffle is on the way from what we understand?
It's in process now. You mentioned the pending power cuts, which Rishi Sunak himself warned would happen. Well, the lights are going off on the popularity of the Conservative Party, and you could say that Liz Truss was massively instrumental in putting the Conservative Party 30 percentage points behind Labour. It's not because I think that Keir Starmer's doing a particularly good job. I think he's a rather poor opposition leader. But by default, the Conservatives are so unpopular that people go to Labour thinking, well, anyone but the Conservatives. And Boris Johnson didn't help either. What can he do is the question you asked me. What he can do is a good job of the economy. He can stop those power cuts, because if the power cuts come, everyone will remember, at least people of my age, will remember the winter of discontent, as it was called in 1978 and 1979, a line which Margaret Thatcher, a Tory opposition leader, went on to be Prime Minister, used against Labour. Well, they'll get that thrown right back in their face. Internally, he also has problems, because some people still blame Rishi Sunak for the demise of Boris Johnson's premiership. And because there wasn't an election, let's remember, Rishi Sunak was not elected prime minister. He was appointed by minister by default. That means there's that discontent in the party too. Can he pull it back? Not without some luck. He needs to be lucky that there aren't power cuts, because that will really put the lights out on popularity of the Tories right up to the next election. And he needs to be lucky with party discipline, because there isn't much of that either at the moment. It remains to be seen if he has the leadership to do those things. For the sake of my own quality of life, I hope he does. But there's an awful lot of doubt. And Rishi Sunak, if he makes it to the election, well and good. If he gets deposed, there will be a general election, because the Conservative Party is almost torn apart as it is.
Okay. Unfortunately, we have to get back into the economy again here, Shabir Rizvi, based on how things are going. But an important stat that I brought up before coming on, and I'm curious as to whether the general public there in the UK even, or the wider world, actually is aware of the fact that more than one in five of the UK population, which is 22%, actually live in poverty. I mean, that's quite a stat, almost a quarter. So if we're looking at that particular stat, all indications are at this point, if this, if the UK is going on the track that it is, that that's going to increase, there needs to be something that bridges the UK finances in order to be able to increase people's livelihoods. And that, I'm talking very generally now, so that people don't have to suffer as much, whether it's, as Lampadopic said, the big three, like mortgages or food or other things, the social services perhaps. That the big question is, where is that money going to come from? I mean, he can't tax his way into generating income. That usually doesn't work, if I'm correct to say that. How do you think he should approach it?
Well, there are possibilities of what you're saying, that yes, one in five have huge difficulties, and also we have on a daily basis 5 million people going to the food banks. So there are a whole host of issues as far as economics is concerned. But the reality is that politics impinges on economics, and economics impinges on politics, if you like. There's two sides of the same coin. And if the political situation is not stable, and the Conservative Party carries on in this way, and I was only reading today before coming on to this interview, is that there are some Conservative Party members who are in the Boris brand, if you like, are already sort of jockeying to get rid of Sunak. And it is said that perhaps he might not last until Christmas. So that's perhaps another development that's taking place, and we'll see what happens. But his really big challenge, as our other guest has pointed out, is really the economic issue, and there aren't sort of any silver bullets for him, if you like. Taxing higher, would that generate enough revenue? Or the thought of growing the economy, as the former previous prime minister kept on saying that she wants to grow the economy. How will they grow the economy? Which sectors of the economy would grow? And then, of course, the whole issue of immigration. Do immigrants, new immigrants coming in, contribute to the growth of the economy? Because of the whole sort of problems and challenges and the sort of maligning of immigrants and asylum seekers in the UK, that again is not an avenue that is open to the UK to bring in new blood, sure, from foreign countries to grow the economy.
Okay, we only have 30 seconds, Lampadopic. £2.5 billion so far assistance to Ukraine. UK has announced that it will match it for the year 2023. That's £12 million per day. How could the UK afford that?
It's a political necessity for Rishi Sunak. If he looks like he's not going to be sponsoring Ukraine, he'll be accused of weak leadership. The rights and the wrongs of it in military terms and political terms don't matter, except to save his back.
Thank you so much. We're going to have to end in there. Lampadopic there, former member of the British Parliament from London, and also from London, Shabir Rizvi, political analyst. Thank you to you both. And that is it for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Vitapoy and the team. It's goodbye. Until the next program.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.